This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. I love musicals and was really grateful to conductor and music historian John McGlynn for restoring musicals, going back to the original scores so that he could include music and songs that had never been recorded before. We're listening to the overture from his recorded restoration of Showboat. He also recorded restorations of Annie Get Your Gun, Anything Goes, and an obscure Jerome Kern musical called Sitting Pretty. We were surprised and saddened to read his obituary today. He died Saturday at the age of 55 of an apparent heart attack. He joined us several times on Fresh Air. We're going to hear excerpts of two of his interviews. The first time we spoke was in 1989, after the release of his recorded restoration of the 1927 Jerome Kern Oscar Hammerstein musical, Showboat. McGlynn explained why Showboat is so important in theater history.
Everybody thinks of Oklahoma as the great watershed musical, the piece that, you know, finally integrated book and lyrics and music and dance and all of this. And in point of fact, many people, including myself, feel that Showboat in 1927 was the work that really did that. Showboat addressed issues which, for the time, were absolutely unheard of in the musical theater. You simply did not address issues of racial hatred, racial intermarriage, alcoholism, desertion by a husband. Things like that were just not part of what people went to the theater to see when they went to see a Florenz Ziegfeld musical.
How would you describe your overall vision in recording the complete Showboat?
It had always bothered me, both as an artist and as a fan, that Showboat had come to be known as the sort of light, frothy operetta. And I had always suspected that there were much deeper elements to it. And the more I studied the piece and the more I was able to get back to the original material and I saw what the full original scope of their conception was, I realized that this was really something extraordinarily dark and brooding and out of the ordinary. And in the recording, I felt it was absolutely imperative to restore all of the grit and the drama of the piece. There are several examples I can use, but the most important one, and the one that's obviously caused the most discussion, has been the restoration of the original language. I mean, the opening line of the show has always been a source of controversy. The curtain goes up on a levee in Mississippi, and it's in the 1880s, and the stage is full of these sweating black stevedores lugging cotton bales on their backs in the hot July sun, and the first words out of their mouth are, "Niggers all work on the Mississippi, niggers all work while the white men play." And Hammerstein wrote that word deliberately. It wasn't just the word that everybody used then and used thoughtlessly. He wanted to pick the word that would make this complacent society audience sit up and take notice and think about what life was like for these people 100 years ago in Mississippi.
Now, a lot of us know Old Man River opening with the lyrics, "Colored folk work on the Mississippi," or "Here we all work on the Mississippi." You restored it to the original, as you just described. But it caused quite a controversy within the cast that you were recording. A chorus of black singers who were supposed to sing it walked out. The baritone that was supposed to sing it walked out.
Yes.
Let's establish first why they wanted to walk out.
Well, what happened was, it was very unfortunate that because of scheduling and rehearsals, I was not able to be present at the first chorus rehearsal. What we had planned to do was to use the chorus from the Glyndebourne production of Porgy and Bess, because I very much wanted to have a black chorus for the black music in Showboat. They got to the first rehearsal and they opened up their vocal scores, and of course the first word they see staring them in the face was "nigger." Now, they did not know the show. They didn't know the context. They didn't know what the dramatic purpose of the word was. And they just went, "Yipes." And they said, "No way, sorry, we can't do this."
Giving no rest till the judgment day.
Here's your silver.
There's an irony here, I think, and that is that you ended up having to use a white chorus to sing Old Man River because the black chorus didn't want to sing the original text. And this is part of your attempt to get the most authentic recording possible.
Well, not only authentic, but I would like to think the most socially conscious.
Mm-hmm.
Anything that happened like that, whether it be racial prejudice or genocide or anything, if we forget about it, it can happen again. And I think it's very dangerous to try to pretend that things like this never happened.
In your recording of Showboat, you reinstated a very beautiful song, and I think this is the perfect example of the dark and brooding atmosphere that you found when you found the complete manuscript for Showboat. The song I'm thinking of is Misery's Coming Round, and this is a song that foreshadows the tragic turn of events about to happen. It's very beautiful. Why was it deleted?
First of all, at the first performance in Washington, the first preview out of town, the show ran over 4 hours, which was simply not feasible within the format and economic market of a Broadway musical. So things had to go. And the first casualties, of course, were anything that was not absolutely essential to the progression of the plot. And Misery, as beautiful as it is 6 minutes of atmosphere and mood painting rather than something specific happens that moves the plot along. That's the practical aspect. The other side of it is that Florenz Ziegfeld was terrified of it. And Ziegfeld absolutely was so afraid that it was going to kill the show stone cold, smack in the middle of the first act. And I can see him, you know, at rehearsal in my mind's eye, you know, sitting there chewing on a cigar and going, it's a downer, boys, it's a downer. But it's very interesting about Misery because its cutting is tragic because its themes are used as underscoring throughout the entire show. And you hear all these references to this dark, brooding theme without ever hearing its original statement and knowing what its context is.
Misery's coming around. Damn misery's coming around. I knows it's coming around. Don't know to who. Misery's coming around. Damn misery's coming around. We knows it's coming around. Don't know to who.
Better hurry up that cleaning.
Do you think that your recording is an example of a trend in reevaluating the place of the musical theater in American musical life?
Boy, I sure hope so. I mean, so much of my career has been devoted to that, not just with Showboat, but with all the shows that I've worked on. When these shows were being written, nobody thought of them as great art. They were commodities. They were designed to make the authors and the producers money, and that's really all anybody thought about. Now, I'm convinced that late at night in the dark recesses of their studies, the composers themselves did think of it as art. They knew they were creating beautiful music. But even so, they still treated it very much as a commodity. Orchestrations were not preserved. Manuscripts were not even preserved. If a song or a complete show wasn't a big hit, nobody felt it was important to preserve it in case it were going to be reevaluated by posterity 50 years later. What was the miracle that created people like Irving Berlin and Richard Rodgers and Jerome Kern and Cole Porter and Dietz and Schwartz, all at this one time, these incredible people? And artistry like that, and quite apart from the style has changed, but just that kind of artistry doesn't seem to exist en masse today. People just didn't think that it was all going to end. So I think now, you know, people are realizing that we've lost something incredibly precious and we better find it and reclaim it and preserve it as fast as we can.
John McGlynn recorded in 1989, after the release of his recorded restoration of Showboat. He died Saturday at the age of 55. We're remembering theater music historian and conductor John McGlynn. He died Saturday at the age of 55 of an apparent heart attack.
Now, little lady, if you'll step up to the parapet, I'll give you a lesson in marksmanship.
You couldn't give me a lesson in long-distance spitting. Anything you can do, I can do better. I can do anything better than you.
No, you can't.
Yes, I can.
No, you can't.
Yes, I can.
No, you can't.
Yes, I can. Yes, I can.
Anything you can be, I can be greater. Sooner or later, I'm greater than you.
No, you're not.
Yes, I am.
No, you're not.
Yes, I am.
No, you're not.
Yes, I am. Yes, I am. I can shoot a partridge with a single cartridge.
I can get a sparrow with a bow and arrow.
I can live on bread and cheese.
And only on that?
Yeah.
So can a rat.
Any note you can reach, I can go higher.
I can sing anything higher than you.
No, you can't.
Yes, I can.
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 That's Kim Criswell as Annie Oakley and Thomas Hampson as sharpshooter Frank Butler in John McGlynn's recorded restoration of Annie Get Your Gun. McGlynn's specialty was returning to the original scores of classic and obscure Broadway musicals, reinserting music passages and songs that had been deleted over the years and had never been recorded. My second interview with him was recorded in 1992, after the release of his recorded restoration of Annie Get Your Gun. He told me why he restored the score of this popular show.
Annie Get Your Gun, I should explain, exists in two entirely separate and discrete versions. There's the original show that opened in 1946 at the Imperial Theater in New York City, and there was a very famous revival supervised by Irving Berlin in 1966 at Lincoln Center. That production also starred Ethel Merman and was recorded by RCA Victor. And for that production, the original orchestrations were thrown out. New orchestrations were done by Robert Russell Bennett, and some of the score was dropped, a new song was added, the book was shortened, two subsidiary characters were eliminated entirely, and that version, what I would call the Lincoln Center version, is the one that is, in fact, the only version that is currently available for rental and performance. And so I realized that there was a real palpable need, a real reason to go back and record the original 1946 version.
You were talking about the 1966 version and how that's been the only one available in terms of the score. Let me play the overture, the opening of the overture from the 1966 version, and compare that to the restored version that you've done. And I think our listeners will hear that the 1966 version is very heavy on strings and harps, whereas yours is crisper and it there's more horns in it.
Well, you know what there is in the original that there isn't in the 66 version is five saxophones.
Right.
The saxophones were completely eliminated from the 66 version.
And replaced by violins, probably.
Yeah, and more brass.
So I'm gonna start with the 1966 and then I'll go to your new restoration. Would you compare these two?
Well, first of all, let me say that I don't want to be seen in any way to be knocking the 1966 version. It's worth remembering, first of all, Irving Berlin supervised the 66 version, and it was orchestrated by Robert Russell Bennett, who had done a large portion of the orchestrations of the original production. It was reorchestrated for one definite reason and a second reason that I suspect, which I didn't realize until last year. First of all, this production was designed for the New York State Theater. And that is a big house. And I think they felt that orchestrations were needed that would be louder, heavier, punchier, and more in the style of the 1960s. Broadway orchestrations, even though they were very peppy in the 40s, tended to be more delicate. By the 60s, we were into the age of amplification, and it was a huge hall that needed a great deal of sound to fill it. That, I think, is partly the reason. Also, I think it was felt that the sound of the saxophones, that whole 1940s sound, would sound dated to 60s mentality.
What's interesting is that it's the 1966 version that I think really sounds dated.
Now it does, because you know what it is? It's very interesting. I found that this applies to so many of these shows that people go back and doctor. It's what I call malice of hindsight. And you, when something is created new, you're simply creating it. You're doing what is in your heart, what is all around you musically and culturally. You are going with the flow of what you're in the middle of living in. You're not consciously second-guessing yourself. When you go back 20 years later, they did this with Showboat as well, and you try to do new arrangements which are not so much in the style of the 1940s as in what they think people think the style of the 40s was, it never sounds right. It always sounds slightly ersatz, slightly artificial.
Do you sing anymore? I mean, you have a small credit on the Annie Get Your Gun recording. You're on the reprise of There's No Business Like Show Business. I'm not sure if you're just speaking a line there, if you're actually singing.
I sing at rehearsal. I sing when someone's missing. I have, I say modestly, a very pretty little teeny-weeny tiny tenor voice. But it was much too small to do anything with operatically, which is what I wanted to do. And I stopped singing for a very practical reason, which is that it terrified me so that, I mean, I would shake and I would vomit and, oh, it was just horrible. And I thought, this is no life for an adult human being. I'm terribly glad that I went through that. I studied voice for 8 years. I took 3 lessons a week. And I performed in college and all of that. I know what kind of hell singers go through when they perform. And that's terribly useful to me as a conductor. I can hear, before it happens, when a singer is about to run out of breath. I can hear coming out of the throat when the singer needs just that little bit of extra room to get over the register break for a high note. And I think it's one of the reasons singers like working with me so much is that, unlike some conductors, I'm extremely sympathetic to the physical demands of what a singer has to endure in order to produce the sounds they do.
Now, I have to ask you about There's No Business Like Show Business, which is, you know, the anthem from the show. Mm-hmm. Did you go into this still loving that song, or was the song really tired for you, and did you have to work to make it fresh?
No, it wasn't tired for me at all, because, you see, I have a trick. Whenever I feel that something is getting tired for me, I avoid it like the plague, and I go away from it. And that way it stays fresh. I mean, I haven't spent all of my life doing There's No Business Like Show Business, so it isn't old for me. Mm-hmm. Now, sure, you hear it all the time. You hear it sung at the end of every Tony Award ceremony, all that kind of stuff. And it's become so much, you know, a part of our bloodstream that you don't think of it. But when you're doing it in the context of the play and you're using the theater orchestration, you're suddenly, instead of just everybody sort of getting up and singing a song they half know, you're dealing with a song that suddenly has a very specific emotional and theatrical point, which is they are trying to persuade Annie to leave home, to leave Dark County, Ohio, and come with them, join the circus, join the Wild West show. And she's very unsure, so they use this song to get her excited about going into show business. So the situation was unique and fresh and had a dramatic need. There was a reason the song needed to be sung. And when you're working under those kind of circumstances, something can't get old.
Well, John McGlynn, I want to thank you a lot for talking with us.
Well, my pleasure. Thank you.
There's no business like show business, like no business I know. Everything about it is appealing, everything the traffic will allow. Oh, and when you get that happy feeling, when you are stealing that extra bow, there's no people like
told you you would not go far.
That night you open and there you are.
Next day on your dressing room they found a star.
Let's go on with the show.
Our interview with conductor and music theater historian John McGlynn was recorded in 1992 after the CD release of his restoration of Annie Get Your Gun. McGlynn died Saturday at the age of 55. He also conducted and recorded restored versions of Showboat, Anything Goes, Kiss Me Kate, the Jerome Kern musical Sitting Pretty, as well as overtures and songs by Kern, Gershwin, and Rodgers and Hart.